to fostering friendly relations. The Persian Gulf is a region of great importance to the entire world. It is in everyone's interest for that region to remain peaceful and stable. There's been enough war. Iran and Iraq fought for, what, 8 years? At enormous human cost to both countries. Then all the conflicts between Israel and her neighbors. Enough is enough. Now we have a new nation being born. This new country has much work to do. Its citizens have needs, and fortunately they also have the resources to address those needs. We wish them well. If we can help them, we will. America has always been willing to extend the hand of friendship. There was a brief break, which probably denoted a commercial. The interview would run this evening at 9 o'clock. Then Donner turned to his senior colleague, John Plummer, who took the next segment. "So, how do you like being president?" Ryan tilted his head and smiled. "I keep telling myself that I wasn't elected. I was sentenced. Honestly, the hours are long, the work is hard, much harder than I ever appreciated. But I've been pretty lucky. Arnie Van Dam is a genius at organization. The staff here at the White House is just outstanding. I've gotten tens of thousands of letters of support from the people outside the Beltway, and I'd like to take this opportunity to thank them, and to let them know that it really helps." "Mr. Ryan," Jack supposed that his Ph.D. didn't count anymore, "what things are you going to try and change?" Plummer asked. "John, that depends on what you mean by change. My foremost task is to keep the government operating. So not change, but restore is what I'm trying to do. We still don't really have a Congress yet, not until the House of Representatives is reestablished, and so I cannot submit a budget. I've tried to pick good people to take over the major cabinet departments. Their job is to run those departments efficiently. Your Secretary of the Treasury, George Winston, has been criticized for his rather abrupt desire to change the federal tax code," Plummer said. "All I can say is that I support Secretary Winston fully. The tax code is unconscionably complicated, and that is fundamentally unfair. What he wants to do will be revenue neutral. Actually, that may be overly pessimistic. The net effect will be to enhance government revenues because of administrative savings in other areas. But there has been a lot of adverse comment about the regressive nature." Ryan held up his hand. "Wait a minute. John, one of the problems in this town is that the language used by people has been warped. Charging everyone the same is not regressive. That word means a backward step, charging the poor more than the rich. We will not be doing that. When you use that word in the incorrect way, you're misleading people. But that's the way people have described the tax system for years." Plummer hadn't had his grammar challenged in years. "That doesn't make it right," Jack pointed out. "In any case, as I keep saying, I am not a politician, John. I only know how to talk straight. Charging everyone the same tax rate fulfills the dictionary's definition of fair. Come on, John, you know how the game is played. You and Tom make a lot of money, far more than I do, and every year your lawyer and accountant go over everything. You probably have investments that are designed to reduce your tax payments, right? How did those loopholes happen?" "Easy. Lobbyists talked Congress into changing the law a little. Why? Because rich people paid them to do so. So what happens? The supposedly progressive system is manipulated in such a way that the increased rates for the rich don't actually apply, because their lawyers and accountants tell them how to beat the system, and they do beat the system, for a fee. So the increased rates they pay are a lie, aren't they? Politicians know all this when they pass the laws. You see where all this takes us? Nowhere, John. It takes us nowhere. It's a great big game, that's all. Just a game that wastes time, misleads the public, and makes a lot of money for people who work the system. And where does the money come from? The citizens. The people who pay for everything that happens. So George Winston wants to change the system, and we agreed on that. And what happens? The people who play the game and work the system use the same misleading words to make it look as though we're doing something unfair. These insiders are the most dangerous and pernicious special interest group there is." "And you don't like that?" John smiled. Every job I've ever had, stockbroker, history teacher, everything else, I've had to tell the truth as best I could. I'm not going to stop that now. Maybe some things do need changing, and I'll tell you what one of them is. Every parent in America sooner or later tells every child that politics is a dirty business, a rough business, a nasty business. Your dad told you. My dad told me. And we accept that as though it makes sense, as though it's normal and right and proper. But it's not, John. For years we've accepted the fact that politics... Wait, let's define terms, shall we? The political system is the way we govern the country, pass the laws we all have to follow, levy taxes. These are important things, aren't they? But at the same time, we accept people into that system whom we would not willingly invite into our homes, whom we would not trust to babysit our children. Does this strike you as just a little odd, John? We allow people into the political system who routinely distort facts, who twist laws in order to suit patrons who give them campaign money, some of whom just plain lie. And we accept this. You people in the media do. You would not accept that sort of behavior in your own profession, would you? Or in medicine, or in science, or in business, or in law enforcement. There's something wrong here, the president went on, leaning forward and talking passionately for the first time. This is our country we're talking about, and the standards of behavior we demand for our representatives shouldn't be lower, they should be higher. We should demand intelligence and integrity. That's why I've been giving speeches around the country. John, I'm a registered independent. I don't have a party affiliation. I don't have an agenda except for wanting to make things work for everyone. I swore an oath to do that, and I take my oaths seriously. Well, I've learned that this upsets people, and I'm sorry about that, but I will not compromise my beliefs to accommodate every special group with an army of paid lobbyists. I'm here to serve everybody, not just to serve the people who make the most noise and offer the most money. Plummer didn't show his pleasure at the outburst. Okay, Mr. President, for starters, then, what about civil rights? The Constitution is colorblind as far as I'm concerned. Discrimination against people because of how they look, how they sound, what church they go to, or the country their ancestors came from, is against the laws of our country. Those laws will be enforced. We are all supposed to be equal in the eyes of the law, whether we obey them or break them. In the latter case, those people will have the Department of Justice to worry about. Isn't that idealistic? What's wrong with idealism? Ryan asked in return. At the same time, what about a little common sense once in a while? Instead of a lot of people chiseling for advantages for themselves or whatever small group they represent, why can't we all work together? Aren't we all Americans before we're anything else? Why can't we all try a little harder to work together and find reasonable solutions to problems? This country wasn't set up to have every group at the throat of every other group. Some would say that's the way we fight things out to make sure that everyone gets a fair share, Plummer observed. And along the way we corrupt the political system. They had to stop for the crew to change tapes on their cameras. Jack looked longingly at the door to the secretary's office, wishing for a smoke. He rubbed his hands together, trying to look relaxed. But though he'd been given the chance to say things he'd wanted to say for years, the opportunity to do so only made him more tense. The cameras are off, Tom Donner said, settling back in his seat a little. Do you really think you can bring any of this off? If I don't try, what does that make me? Jack sighed. The government's a mess. We all know that. If nobody tries to fix it, then it'll just get worse. Donner almost felt sympathy for his subject at that point. This Ryan guy's sincerity was manifest, as though his heart were beating right there on the sleeve of his jacket. But he just didn't get it. It wasn't that Ryan was a bad guy. He was just out of his depth, just as everyone else said. Keelty was right, and because he was right, Donner had his job to do. Ready, the producer said. The Supreme Court, Donner said, taking up the questioning from his colleague. It's been reported that you are now looking over a list of prospective justices for submission to the Senate. Yes, I am, Ryan replied. What can you tell us about them? I instructed the Justice Department to send me a list of experienced appeals court judges. That's been done. I'm looking over the list now. What exactly are you looking for? Donner asked next. I'm looking for good judges. The Supreme Court is our nation's primary custodian of the Constitution. We need people who understand that responsibility and who will interpret the laws fairly.
Strict constructionists?
Tom, the Constitution says that the Congress makes the law, the executive branch enforces the law, and the courts explain the law. That's called checks and balances. But historically, the Supreme Court has been an important force for change in our country, Donner said.
And not all of those changes have been good ones. Dred Scott started the Civil War. Plessy versus Ferguson was a disgrace that set our country back 70 years. Please, you need to remember that as far as the law is concerned, I'm a layman.
That's why the American Bar Association routinely goes over judicial appointments. Will you submit your list to the ABA?
No.
Ryan shook his head.
First, all of these judges have already passed that hurdle in order to get where they are. Second, the ABA is also an interest group, isn't it?
Fine, they have a right to look out for the interests of their members. But the Supreme Court is the body of government which decides the law for everybody, and the ABA is the organization of people who use the law to make a living.
Isn't it a conflict of interest for the group which makes use of the law to select the people who define the law? It would be in any other field, wouldn't it?
Not everyone will see it that way.
Yes, and the ABA has a big office here in Washington, and it's full of lobbyists, the president agreed.
Tom, my job isn't to serve the interest groups. My job is to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution to the best of my ability. To help me do that, I'm trying to find people who think the same way I do, that the oath means what it says, without any game-playing under the table.
Donner turned.
John?
You spent many years at the Central Intelligence Agency, Plummer said.
Yes, I did, Jack agreed.
Doing what? Plummer asked.
Mainly I worked in the Directorate of Intelligence, going over information that came in through various means, trying to figure out what it meant, and then passing it on to others. Eventually I headed the Intelligence Directorate. Then, under President Fowler, I became Deputy Director.
Then, as you know, I became National Security Advisor to President Durling, Jack answered, trying to steer the talk forward rather than backward.
Along the way, did you ever go out into the field? Plummer asked.
Well, I advised the Arms Control Negotiations Team, and I went off to a lot of conferences, the president replied.
Mr. Ryan, there are reports that you did more than that, that you participated in operations that resulted in the deaths of... well, the deaths of Soviet citizens.
Jack hesitated for a moment, long enough that he knew the impression he'd be giving to the viewers for this special.
John, it's been a principle of our government for many years that we never comment on intelligence operations. I will not change that principle.
The American people have a right and a need to know what sort of man sits in this office, Plummer insisted.
This administration will never discuss intelligence operations. As far as what sort of person I am, that's the purpose of this interview. Our country has to keep some secrets.
So do you, John, Ryan said with a level gaze into the commentator's eyes.
If you reveal sources, you're out of business. If America does the same thing, people get hurt.
But the subject is closed, John. Our intelligence services operate under congressional oversight. I've always supported that law, and I will continue to uphold it. And that's it on this subject.
Both reporters blinked pretty hard at that, and surely, Ryan thought, that part of the tape wouldn't make it onto the network tonight.
Badrein needed to select 30 people, and while the number wasn't especially difficult, nor was the required dedication, brains were. He had the contacts. If there was a surplus of anything in the Middle East, it was terrorists, men like himself, if somewhat younger, who had dedicated their lives to the cause, only to have it wither before their eyes. And that only made their anger and dedication worse, and better, depending on one's point of view. On reflection, he needed only 20 smart ones. The rest just had to be dedicated, with one or two intelligent overseers. They all had to follow orders. They all had to be willing to die, or at least to take the chance. Well, that wasn't much of a problem either. Hezbollah still had a supply of people willing to strap explosives to their bodies, and there were others. It was part of the region's tradition, probably not one that Mohammed would have approved entirely, but Bahrain wasn't particularly religious, and terrorist operations were his business. Historically, Arabs had not been the world's most efficient soldiers. Nomadic tribesmen for most of their history, their military tradition was one of raiding, later quantified as guerrilla tactics, rather than set-piece battle, which was, in fact, an invention of the Greeks, passed along to the Romans, and thence to all Western nations. Historically, a single person would step forward to become a sacrifice. In Viking tradition, the person was called a berserker. And in Japan, they'd been part of the special attack corps, also known as kamikaze. On the field of battle, to swing his sword gloriously, and take as many of his foes off to be his servants in paradise as possible. This was especially true in a jihad or holy war, whose objective was to serve the interests of the faith. It ultimately proved that Islam, like any religion, could be corrupted by its adherents. For the moment, it meant that Bahrain had a supply of people who would do what he told them to do, his instructions relayed from Daryai, who would also tell them that this was indeed a jihad service in which lay their individual keys to a glorious afterlife. He had his list. He made 3 telephone calls. The calls were relayed through several cut-out chains, and in Lebanon and elsewhere people made travel plans.
"So, how'd we do, Coach?" Jack asked with a smile.
"The ice got pretty thin, but I guess you didn't get wet," Arnie Van Dam said with visible relief. "You hit the interest groups pretty hard."
"Isn't it okay to trash the special interests? Hell, everybody else does."
"It depends on which groups and which interests, Mr. President. They all have spokespersons, too, and some of them can come across like Mother Teresa after a nice pill, right before they slash your throat with a machete."
The chief of staff paused.
"Still, you handled yourself pretty well. You didn't say anything they could turn against you too badly. We'll see how they cut it up for tonight, and then what Donner and Plummer say at the end. The last couple of minutes count the most."
The tubes arrived in Atlanta in a very secure container called a hatbox because of its shape. It was, in its way, a highly sophisticated device designed to hold the most dangerous of materials in total safety, multi-sealed, and specced to survive violent impacts. It was covered with biohazard warning labels and was treated with great respect by the handlers, including the FedEx delivery man who'd handed it over this morning at 9:14. The hat box was taken to a secure lab where the outside was checked for damage, sprayed with a powerful chemical disinfectant, and then opened under strict containment procedures. The accompanying documents explained why this was necessary. The 2 blood tubes were suspected to contain viruses which caused hemorrhagic fever. That could mean any of several such diseases from Africa, the indicated continent of origin, all of which were things to be avoided. A technician working in a glove box made the transfer after examining the containers for leaks. There were none he could see, and more disinfectant spray made sure of that. The blood would be tested for antibodies and compared with other samples. The documentation went off to the office of Dr. Lorenz in the Special Pathogens Branch.
"Gus? Alex," Dr. Lorenz heard on the phone.
"Still not getting any fishing in?"
"Maybe this weekend. There's a guy in neurosurgery with a boat, and we have the house pretty well set up, finally."
Dr. Alexander was looking out the window of his office at East Baltimore. One could see the harbor, which led to the Chesapeake Bay, and there were supposed to be rockfish out there.
"What's happening?" Gus asked, as his secretary came in with a folder.
"Just checking in on the outbreak in Zaire. Anything new?"
"Zip, thank God.
We're out of the critical time.
This one burned out in a hurry. We were very...
Lauren stopped when he opened the folder and scanned the cover sheet.
Wait a minute. Khartoum, he muttered to himself.
Alexander waited patiently. Lorenz was a slow, careful reader. An elderly man, rather like Ralph Forster, he took his time with things, which was one of the reasons he was a brilliant experimental scientist. Lorenz rarely took a false step. He thought too much before moving his feet.
We just had two samples come in from Khartoum. Cover sheet is from a Dr. McGregor, the English hospital in Khartoum. Two patients, adult male and 4-year-old female. Possible hemorrhagic fever. The samples are in the lab now.
Khartoum? Sudan?
That's what it says, Gus confirmed.
Long way from the Congo, man.
Airplanes, Alex. Airplanes, Lawrence observed.
If there was one thing that frightened epidemiologists, it was international air travel. The cover sheet didn't say much, but it did give phone and fax numbers.
Okay, well, we have to run the tests and see.
What about the samples from before?
Finished the mapping yesterday. Ebola Zaire, Mayinga subtype, identical with the samples from 1976 down to the last amino acid.
The airborne one, Alexander muttered. The one that got George Westfall.
That was never established, Alex, Lawrence reminded him.
George was careful, Gus, you know that. You trained him.
Pierre Alexander rubbed his eyes. Headaches. He needed a new desk light.
Let me know what those samples tell you, okay?
Sure. I wouldn't worry too much. Sudan is a crummy environment for this little bastard. Hot, dry, lots of sunlight. The virus wouldn't last 2 minutes in the open.
Anyway, let me talk to my lab chief. I'll see if I can micrograph it myself later today.
No, more likely tomorrow morning. I have a staff meeting in an hour.
Yeah, and I need some lunch. Talk to you tomorrow, Gus.
Alexander, he still thought of himself more as colonel than professor, replaced the phone and walked out, heading off to the cafeteria. He was pleased to find Kathy Ryan in the food line again, along with her bodyguard.
"Hey, Prof."
"How's the bug business?" she asked with a smile.
"Same-o, same-o. I need a consult, doctor," he said, selecting a sandwich off the counter.
"I don't do viruses."
But she did enough work with AIDS patients whose eye troubles were secondary to their main problem.
"What's the problem?"
"Headaches," he said on the way to the cashier.
"Oh?"
Kathy turned and took his glasses right off his face. She held them up to the light.
"You might try cleaning them once in a while. You're about 2 diopters of minus, pretty strong astigmatism. How long since you had the prescription checked?"
She handed them back with a final look at the encrusted dirt around the lenses, already knowing the answer to her question.
"Oh, 3 years.
You should know better. Have your secretary call mine and I'll have you checked out. Join us?"
They selected a table by the window, with Roy Altman in tow, scanning the room and catching looks from the other detail members doing the same. All clear.
"You know, you might be a good candidate for our new laser technique. We can reshape your cornea and bring you right down to 20/20, she told him.
She'd helped ramrod that program, too.
"Is it safe?" Professor Alexander asked dubiously.
"The only unsafe procedures I perform are in the kitchen," Professor Ryan replied with a raised eyebrow.
"Yes, ma'am," Alex grinned.
"What's new on your side of the house?"
It was all in the editing. Well, mostly in the editing, Tom Donner thought, typing on his office computer. From that he would slide in his own commentary, explaining and clarifying what Ryan had really meant with his seemingly sincere... seemingly. The word had leaped into his mind of its own accord, startling the reporter. Donner had been in the business for quite a few years, and before his promotion to network anchor, he'd been in Washington. He'd covered them all and knew them all. On his well-stuffed Rolodex was a card with every important name and number in town. Like any good reporter,
He was connected.
He could lift a phone and get through to anyone, because in Washington the rules for dealing with the media were elegantly simple. Either you were a source or a target. If you didn't play ball with the media, they would quickly find an enemy of yours who did. In other contexts, the technical term was blackmail. Donner's instincts told him that he'd never met anyone like President Ryan before, at least not in public life. Or was that true? The I'm one of you, every man stance went at least as far back as Julius Caesar. It was always a ploy, a sham to make voters think that the guy really was like them. But he never was, really. Normal people didn't get this far in any field. Ryan had advanced in CIA by playing office politics just like everyone else. He must have. He'd made enemies and allies, as everyone did, and maneuvered his way up. And the leaks he'd gotten about Ryan's tenure at CIA, could he use them? Not in the special. Maybe in the news show, which would contain a teaser anyway to make people watch it instead of their usual evening TV fare. Donner knew he had to be careful on this. You didn't go after a sitting president for the fun of it. Well, that wasn't true, was it? Going after a president was the best sort of fun, but there were rules about how you did it. Your information had to be pretty solid. That meant multiple sources, and they had to be good sources. Donner would have to take them to a senior official of his news organization, and people would hem and haw, and then they'd go over the copy for his story, and then they'd let him run it. Every man. But every man didn't work for CIA and go into the field to be a spy, did he? Damn sure Ryan was the first spy who'd ever made it to the Oval Office. Was that good? There were so many blanks in his life. The thing in London. He'd killed there. The terrorists who'd attacked his home. He'd killed at least one of them there, too. This incredible story about stealing a Soviet submarine, during which, his source said, he'd killed a Russian sailor. The other things. Was this the sort of person the American people wanted in the White House? And yet he tried to come across as everyman. Common sense. This is what the law says. I take my oath seriously. It's a lie, Donner thought. It has to be a lie. You're one clever son of a bitch, Ryan, the anchorman thought. And if it was that he was clever, and if it was a lie, then what? Changing the tax system? Changes in the Supreme Court? Changes in the name of efficiency? Secretary Brentano's activities at defense? Damn. The next leap of imagination was that CIA and Ryan had had a role in the crash at the Capitol. No, that was too crazy. Ryan was an opportunist. They all were, the people Donner had covered for all of his professional life, all the way back to his first job at the network affiliate in Des Moines, where his work had landed a county commissioner in jail, and so gotten Donner noticed by the network executives at 30 Rock. Political figures. Donner reported on all manner of news from avalanches to warfare, but it was politicians whom he had studied as a profession and a hobby. They were all the same, really. Right place, right time, and they already had the agenda. If he'd learned anything at all, he'd learned that. Donner looked out his window and lifted his phone with one hand while flipping the Rolodex with the other. "Ed, this is Tom. Just how good are those sources, and how quickly can I meet them?" He couldn't hear the smile on the other end of the line. So Hyalur was sitting up now. Such situations provided a relief that never failed to awe the young doctor. Medicine was the most demanding of the professions, MacGregor believed. Every day, to a greater or lesser degree, he diced with death. He didn't think of himself as a soldier or a warrior knight on a blooded charger, at least not in conscious terms, because death was an enemy who never showed himself. But he was always there, even so. Every patient he treated had that enemy inside, or hovering about somewhere, and his job as a physician was to discover his hiding place, seek him out, and destroy him. And you saw the victory in the face of the patient, and you savored every one. So Hyla was still unwell, but that would pass. She was on liquids now, and she was keeping them down. Still weak, she would grow no weaker. Her temperature was down. All her vital signs were either stabilized or heading back to normal. This was a victory. Death wouldn't claim this child. In the normal course of events, she would grow and play and learn and marry and have children of her own. But it was a victory for which MacGregor could not really take credit, at least not all of it. His care for the child had been merely supportive, not curative. Had it helped? Probably, he told himself. You couldn't know where the line was between what would have happened on its own and what had made a real difference. Medicine would be far easier if its practitioners possessed that degree of sight. But they didn't yet, and probably never would. Had he not treated her? Well, in this climate just the heat might have done it, or certainly the dehydration, or maybe some opportunistic secondary infection. People so often expired, not from their primary ailment, but from something else that took hold from the general weakening of the body. And so, yes, he would claim this victory. Better yet, that it was the life of a charming and attractive little girl, who would in just a short time learn to smile again. MacGregor took her pulse, savoring the touch of the patient, as he always did, and the remote contact with a heart that would still be beating a week from now. And as he watched, she fell off to sleep. He gently replaced the hand on the bed and turned. "Your daughter will recover fully," he told the parents, confirming their hopes and crushing their fears with 5 quiet words and a warm smile. The mother gasped as though punched, her mouth open, tears exploding from her eyes as she covered her face with her hands. The father took the news in what he deemed a more manly way, his face impassive, but not his eyes, which relaxed and looked up to the ceiling in relief. Then he seized the doctor's hand, and his dark eyes came back down to bore in on MacGregor's. "I will not forget," the general told him. Then it was time to see Sally, something he'd consciously delayed. MacGregor left the room and walked down the corridor. Outside he changed into a different set of clothing. Inside he saw a defeat. The man was under restraints. The disease had entered his brain. Dementia was yet another symptom of Ebola, and a merciful one. Sally's eyes were vacant and stared at the watermarks on the ceiling. The nurse in attendance handed him the chart, the news on which was uniformly bad. MacGregor scanned it, grimaced, and wrote an order to increase the morphine drip. Supportive care in this case hadn't mattered a damn. One victory, one loss. And if he'd had the choice of which to save and which to lose, this was how he'd have written the story. For Sally was grown and had had a life of sorts. That life had but 5 days to run, and MacGregor could do nothing now to save it, only a few things to make its final passage less gruesome for the patient and the staff. After 5 minutes he left the room, stripped off his protective garb, and walked to his office, his face locked in a frown of thought. Where had it come from? Why would one survive and one die? What didn't he know that he needed to know? The physician poured himself a cup of tea and tried to think past the victory and the defeat, in order to find the information that had decided both issues. Same disease, same time. 2 very different outcomes. Why? Chapter 32. Reruns. "I can't give this to you, and I can't let you copy any of it, but I can let you look at it." He handed the photo over. He had light cotton gloves on, and he'd already given a pair to Donner. "Fingerprints," he explained quietly. "Is this what I think it is?" It was a black-and-white photograph, 8x10 glossy, but there was no classification stamp on it, at least not on the front. Donner didn't turn it over. "You really don't want to know, do you?" It was a question and a warning. "I guess not." Donner nodded, getting the message.
He didn't know how the Espionage Act, 18 U.S. Code, Section 793E, interacted with his First Amendment rights, but if he didn't know that the photo was classified, then he didn't have to find out. That's a Soviet nuclear missile submarine, and that's Jack Ryan on the gangway. You'll notice he's wearing a Navy uniform. This was a CIA operation, run in cooperation with the Navy, and that's what we got out of it. The man handed over a magnifying glass to make sure that the identifications were positive. We conned the Soviets into thinking she'd exploded and sunk about halfway between Florida and Bermuda. They probably still think that. "Where is it now?" Donner asked. "They sank her a year later, off Puerto Rico," the CIA official explained. "Why there?" "Deepest Atlantic water close to American territory, about 5 miles down. So nobody will ever find her, and nobody can even look without us knowing." "This was back—" "I remember," Donner said. "The Russians had a big exercise going, and we raised hell about it. And they actually lost a submarine, didn't—"
"Two."
Another photo came out of the folder. "See the damage to the submarine's bow? Red October rammed and sank another Russian sub off the Carolinas. It's still there. The Navy didn't recover that one, but they sent down robots and stripped a lot of useful things off the hulk. It was covered as salvage activity on the first one. That sank from a reactor accident. The Russians never found out what happened to the second Alpha."
"And this never leaked?"
"It was pretty amazing to a man who'd spent years extracting facts from the government, like a dentist with an unwilling patient." "Ryan knows how to hush things up." Another photo. "That's a body bag. The person inside was a Russian crewman. Ryan killed him. Shot him with a pistol. That's how he got his first intelligence star. I guess he figured we couldn't risk having him tell. Well, isn't too hard to figure, is it?"
"Murder?"
"No. The CIA man wasn't willing to go that far. The official story is that it was a real shootout, that other people got hurt also. That's how the documents read in the file, but—"
"Yeah, you have to wonder, don't you?" Donner nodded, staring down at the photos. "Could this possibly be faked?"
"Possibly, yes," he admitted. "But it's not. The other people in the photo, Admiral Dan Foster, he was chief of naval operations back then. This one is Commander Bartolomeo Mancuso. Back then, he commanded USS Dallas. He was transferred to Red October to facilitate the defection. He's still on active duty, by the way, an admiral now. He commands all the submarines in the Pacific. And that one is Captain Marko Aleksandrovich Ramius of the Soviet Navy. He was captain of Red October. They're all still alive. Ramius lives in Jacksonville, Florida now. He works at the Navy's base at Mayport under the name Mark Ramsey. Consulting contract, he explained. The usual thing. Got a big stipend from the government, too, but God knows he earned it. Donner noted the details, and he recognized one of the extraneous faces. Sure as hell, this wasn't faked. There were rules for that, too. If somebody lied to a reporter, it wasn't all that hard to make sure the right people found out who had broken the law. Worse yet, that person became a target. And the media was, in its way, a crueler prosecutor than anyone in the Justice Department could ever hope to be. The court system, after all, required due process of law.
Okay, the journalist said.
The first set of photos went back in their folder. Another folder appeared, and from it a photograph.
Recognize this guy?
He was... Wait a minute. Gera something. He was... Nikolai Gerasimov. He was chairman of the old KGB. Killed in a plane crash back in... Another photo went down. The subject was older, grayer, and looking far more prosperous. This picture was taken in Winchester, Virginia, 2 years ago. Ryan went to Moscow, covered as a technical advisor to the START talks. He got Gerasimov to defect. Nobody's exactly sure how.
His wife and daughter got out, too. That op was run directly out of Judge Moore's office. Ryan worked that way a lot. He was never really part of the system. Ryan knows. Well, look, in fairness to the guy, he's one hell of a spook, okay? He supposedly worked directly for Jim Greer as part of the DI, not the DO. A cover within a cover. Ryan's never made an operational mistake that I know of, and that's some record. Not too many others can claim that. But one reason for it is he's one ruthless son of a bitch. Effective, yes, but ruthless. He cut through all the bureaucracy whenever he wanted. He does it his way every time. And if you get in his way... Well, there's one dead Russian we buried off the Red October, and a whole Alpha crew off the Carolinas to keep that op a secret. This one, I'm not sure. Nothing in the file, but the file has a lot of blanks. How the wife and daughter got out, it's not in the file. All I have for that are rumors, and they're pretty thin. Damn, I wish I'd had this a few hours ago. Rolled you, did he? This question came from Ed Keelty over a speakerphone. I know the problem, the CIA official said. Ryan is slick. I mean slick. He skated through CIA like Dorothy Hamill at Innsbruck, done it for years. Congress loves him. Why? He comes across as the most straightforward guy this side of Honest Abe. Except he's killed people. The man's name was Paul Webb, and he was a senior official in the Directorate of Intelligence, but not senior enough to prevent his whole unit from ending up on the reduction in force list. He should have been DDI now, Webb thought, and he would have been, except for the way Ryan had gotten James Greer's ear and never let go of it. And so his career had ended as an entry-level supergrade at CIA, and now that was being taken away from him. He had his retirement. Nobody could take that away. Well, if it became known that he'd smuggled these files out of Langley, he'd be in very deep trouble. Or maybe not. What really happened to whistleblowers, after all? The media protected them pretty well. And he had his time in service. And he didn't like being part of a reduction-in-force exercise. In another age, though he didn't admit it even to himself, his anger might have prompted him to make contact with... No, not that. Not to an enemy. But the media wasn't an enemy, was it? He told himself that it was not, despite an entire career of thinking otherwise. "You've been rolled, Tom," Keelty said again over the phone line. "Welcome to the club. I don't even know all the stuff he can pull off. Paul, tell him about Columbia." "There's no file on that one that I can find," Webb admitted. "Wherever it is... Well, there are special files, the ones with date stamps on them. Like 2050 at the earliest. Nobody sees those." "How does that happen?" Donner demanded. "I've heard that before, but I've never been able to confirm." "How they keep those off the books?" "It's a deal that has to go through Congress. An unwritten part of the oversight process. The agency goes there with a little problem, asks for special treatment, and if Congress agrees... Off the file goes into the special vault. Hell, for all I know, the whole thing's been shredded and turned into compost. But I can give you a few verifiable facts," Webb concluded with an elegant dangle. "I'm listening," Donner replied. And so was his tape recorder. "How do you suppose the Colombians broke up the Medellin cartel?" Webb asked, drawing Donner in further. "It wasn't all that hard." "These people thought they knew about intrigue," Webb thought with a benign smile. "Well, they had some sort of internal faction fight. A couple of bombs went off, and they were CIA bombs. Somehow, I'm not sure exactly how, we initiated the faction fight. This I do know. Ryan was down there. His mentor at Langley was James Greer. They were like father and son. But when James died... Ryan wasn't there for the funeral, and he wasn't at home, and he wasn't away on CIA business. He'd just come back from a NATO conference in Belgium. But then he just dropped off the map, like he's done any number of times. Soon thereafter, the president's national security advisor, Jim Cutter,
is accidentally run down by a DC transit bus on the GW, right?
He didn't look. He just ran in front of a bus. That's what the FBI said, but the guy running that was Dan Murray, and what job does he have now? FBI director, right? It just so happens he and Ryan go back more than 10 years. Murray was the special guy for both Emil Jacobs and Bill Shaw. When the Bureau needed something done quietly, they called in Murray. Before that, he was legal attaché in London. That's a spook post. Lots of contacts with the intelligence communities over there. Murray's the black side of FBI, big time and well-connected. And he picked Pat Martin to advise Ryan on Supreme Court appointments. Is the picture becoming clear? Wait a minute. I know Dan Murray. He's a tough son of a bitch, but he's an honest cop. He was in Colombia with Ryan, which is to say he was off the map at exactly the same time. Okay, remember, I do not have the file on this operation, okay? I can't prove any of this. Look at the sequence of events. Director Jacobs and all the others were killed. And right after that, we have bombs going off in Colombia, and a lot of the cartel boys go to talk it over with God. But a lot of innocent people got killed, too. That's the problem with bombs. Remember how Bob Fowler made an issue of that? So what happens then? Ryan disappears. Murray does, too. I figure they went down to turn the operation off before it got totally out of hand. And then Cutter dies at a very convenient moment. Cutter didn't have the balls for wet work. He probably knew that. And people probably were afraid he'd crack because he just didn't have the nerve. But Ryan sure as hell did, and still does. Murray, well, you kill the FBI director, and you piss off a very serious organization. And I can't say I disapprove. Those Medellin bastards stepped way over the line, and they did it in an election year, and Ryan was in the right place to play a little catch-up ball. And so somebody issued him a hunting license, and maybe things got a little out of hand. It happens. And so he goes down there to shut it down. Successfully, Webb emphasized. In fact, the whole operation was a success. The cartel came apart. Another one took its place, Donner objected. Webb nodded with an insider's smile. True. And they haven't killed any American officials, have they? Somebody explain to them what the rules are. Again, I will not say that what Ryan did was wrong, except for one little thing. What's that? Donner asked, disappointing Webb, though he was fully caught up in the story now. When you deploy military forces into a foreign country and kill people, it's called an act of war. But again, Ryan skated. The boy's got some beautiful moves. Jim Greer trained him well. You could drop Ryan in a septic tank and he'll come out smelling like Old Spice. So what's your beef with him? You finally asked, Webb observed. Jack Ryan is probably the best intelligence operator we've had in 30 years. The best since Alan Dulles. Maybe the best since Bill Donovan. Red October was a brilliant coup. Getting the chairman of KGB out was even better. The thing in Colombia, well, they twisted the tiger's tail. And they forgot that the tiger has great big claws. Okay, Webb allowed. Ryan's a king spook. But he needs somebody to tell him what the law is, Tom. A guy like this would never get elected, Keelty observed, straining himself to say as little as possible. 3 miles away, his own chief of staff almost pulled the phone away from him. They were so close to getting the message across. Fortunately, Webb carried on. He's done a great job at the agency. He was even a good advisor for Roger Durling, but that's not the same as being president. Yeah, he rolled you, Mr. Donner. Maybe he rolled Durling. Probably not, but who can say? But this guy is rebuilding the whole fucking government, and he's building it in his image, in case you didn't notice. Every appointment he's made, they're all people he's worked with, some for a long time. Or they were selected for him by close associates. Murray running the FBI. Do you want Dan Murray in charge of America's most powerful law enforcement agency?
You want these two people picking the Supreme Court? Where will he take us?
Webb paused and sighed. I hate doing this. He's one of us at Langley, but he isn't supposed to be president, okay? I have an obligation to my country, and my country isn't Jack Ryan.
Webb collected the photos and tucked them back in the folders.
I gotta get back. If anyone finds out what I've done, well, look what happened to Jim Cutter.
Thank you, Donner said.
Then he had some decisions to make. His watch said 3:15, and he had to make them fast. Driving that decision would be a well-understood fact. There was something in creation even more furious than a woman scorned. It was a reporter who'd discovered that he'd been rolled. All nine were dying. It would take from 5 to 8 days, but they were all doomed, and they all knew it. Their faces stared at the overhead cameras, and they had no illusions now. Their executions would be even crueler than the courts had decided for them. Or so they thought. This group promised to be more dangerous than the first. They just knew more of what was going on. And, as a result, they were more fully restrained. As Mahoudi watched, the army medics went in to draw blood samples from the subjects, which would be necessary to confirm and then to quantify the degree of their infection. On their own, the medics had come up with a way to keep the patients from struggling during the process. The jerked arm at the wrong moment could make one of the medical corpsmen stab the needle into the wrong body. And so, while one man did the sample, the other held a knife across the subject's throat. Doomed though the criminals believed themselves to be, they were criminals and cowards, and therefore unwilling to hasten their deaths. It wasn't good medical technique, but then nobody in the building was practicing good medicine. Mahoudi watched the process for a few minutes and left the monitoring room. They'd been overly pessimistic on many things, and one of them was the quantity of virus that would be needed. In the culturing tank, the Ebola had consumed the monkey kidneys and blood with a gusto whose results chilled even the director. Though it happened fundamentally at the molecular level, overall it was like seeing ants going after dead fruit, seeming to come from nowhere and then covering it, turning it black with their bodies. So it was with the Ebola virus. Even though it was too small to see, there were literally trillions of them eating and displacing the tissue offered them as food. What had been one color was now another, and you didn't have to be a physician to know that the contents of the chamber were hateful beyond words. It chilled his blood merely to look at the dreadful soup. There were liters of it now, and they were growing more, using human blood taken from the Tehran Central Blood Bank. The director was examining a sample under the electron microscope, comparing it with another. As Mahoudi approached, he could see the date stamp labels on each. One was from Jean-Baptiste. The other was newly arrived from a patient in the second group of nine.
"They're identical, Mahoudi," he said, turning when the younger man approached.
This was not as much to be expected as one might think. One of the problems with viruses was that, since they were scarcely alive at all, they were actually ill-suited for proper reproduction. The RNA strand lacked an editing function to ensure that each generation would fully follow in the footsteps of its predecessor. It was a serious adaptive weakness of Ebola, and many other similar organisms. Sooner or later, each Ebola outbreak petered out, and this was one of the reasons. The virus itself, maladapted to the human host, became less virulent. And that was what made it the ideal biological weapon. It would kill. It would spread. Then it would die before doing too much of the latter. How much it did of the former was a function of the initial distribution. It was both horribly lethal and also self-limiting.
"So we have at least 3 generations of stability," Mahoudi observed.
"And, by extrapolation, probably 7 to 9. The project director, whatever his perversion of medical science, was a conservative on technical issues. Modi would have said 9 to 11. Better that the director was right, he admitted to himself, turning away. On a table at the far wall were 20 cans, similar to the ones used to infect the first collection of criminals, but slightly modified. They were labeled as economy-size cans of a popular European shaving cream. The company was actually American-owned, which amused everyone associated with the project. They'd been exactly what they said, and been bought singly in 12 different cities in 5 different countries, as the lot numbers inked on their curving bottoms showed. Here in the monkey house, they'd been emptied and carefully disassembled for modification. Each would contain a 0.5 liter of the thinned-out soup, plus a neutral gas propellant, nitrogen, which would not involve any chemical reaction with the soup and would not support combustion, and a small quantity of coolant. Another part of the team had already tested the delivery system. There would be no degradation of the Ebola at all for more than 9 hours. After that, with the loss of the coolant, the virus particles would start to die in a linear function. At 9 plus 8 hours, less than 10% of the particles would be dead. But those, Modi told himself, were the weak ones anyway, and probably the particles that would be unlikely to cause illness. At 9 plus 16 hours, 15% would be dead. Thereafter, experiments had revealed every 8 hours, for some reason the numbers seemed to track with thirds of days, an additional 5% would die. And so, it was simple enough. The travelers would all fly out of Tehran. Flight time to London, 7 hours. Flight time to Paris, 30 minutes less. Flight time to Frankfurt, less still. Much of that factor was the time of day, Mouhoudi had learned. In the 3 cities there would be easy connecting flights. Baggage would not be checked because the travelers would be moving on to another country, and therefore customs inspection wasn't necessary, and therefore no one would notice the cans of unusually cold shaving cream. About the time the coolant ran out, the travelers would be in their first-class seats, climbing to cruising altitude to their cities of final destination, and, there again, international air travel worked out nicely. There were direct flights from Europe to New York, to Washington, to Boston, to Philadelphia, to Chicago, to San Francisco, to Los Angeles, to Atlanta, to Dallas, to Orlando, and regular connecting flights to Las Vegas and Atlantic City. In fact, to all of America's convention cities. The travelers would all fly first class, the quicker to claim their luggage and get through customs. They would have good hotel reservations and return tickets that took them out from different airports. From time zero to delivery, no more than 24 hours would pass, and therefore 80% of the Ebola released would be active. After that, it was all random, in Allah's hands. No, Modi shook his head. He was not the director. He would not apply this act to the will of his God. Whatever it might be, however necessary it was to his country, and a new one at that, he would not defile his religious beliefs by saying or even thinking that. Simple enough? It had been simple once, but then it was a legacy of sorts. Sister Jean-Baptiste, her body long since incinerated, instead of leaving children behind as a woman's body ought, disease was its only physical legacy, and that was an act of such malignance that surely Allah must be offended. But she'd left something else, too, a real legacy. Mahudi had once hated all Westerners as unbelievers. In school he'd learned of the Crusades, and how those supposed soldiers of the Prophet Jesus had slaughtered Muslims, as Hitler had later slaughtered Jews, and from that he'd taken the lesson that all Westerners and all Christians were something less than the people of his own faith. And it was easy to hate such people, easy to write them off as irrelevancies in a world of virtue and belief.
but that one woman. What was the West, and what was Christianity? The criminals of the 11th century, or a virtuous woman of the 20th, who denied every human wish she might have had?